work-study program, from all I can see, worked out very well. With I only know of one human being that became a little bit troublesome because of substance abuse. One human being out of the whole crew, out of all of those years. Over to you, John. W2VDH, K2RIW.
Yeah, fine business. Yeah, okay, I'm kind of glad to hear that. That has always been a high point, because that was soon after I had started there at SUNY Farmingdale. I remember them from the late 70s there onward. And I think I do also remember the one case you are talking about. I think I remember my chairman at that time mentioning to me. Okay, that was my only question or comment. I'll let you go on to the next question. Thanks, Dick. Appreciate it.
Now, was there another person? Maybe it was Joe. I'm not sure who had one more question or one more comment. Give me a call that is right now. KQRIW. Okay. We're trying to cut the TechNet down to 3 hours, 1 hour to each of the sections. I've used up my hour, and now we're going to go over to good old Dr. Roy, AC2GS. And Roy, I know you've got a nice puzzle tonight, among other things. So you got it. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. This is AC2GS, and as always, I like to remind people that if you have any mailbag questions for Dick and you can't get on the technical net, or if you have any questions or you want Paul to discuss some topic, or if you have any topics or questions or puzzles for me, please feel free. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Let me write for one sec. Okay, I also want to kind of mention a couple of little things that was discussed earlier. As far as China, as was discussed, they have two big problems. They have a big month-long holiday of the New Year, and I think Spring Festival, and that's one thing, and then they have the coronavirus, which we'll get into a little bit later. Most of these direct ships from China usually go on the proverbial slow boat from China. The government apparently subsidizes boat shipments, so most of the inexpensive stuff that you have direct order from eBay goes on a slow boat, and you'll be lucky if you get it in a month. It's when their wholesaler will pay extra for the air freight that it comes faster. So probably during this month it's going to get very antsy. I have gotten stuff from China. Shipments are reasonably safe. You don't have to worry too much about it, but they're all confused over there. Also, I have put up on my website, the link page, a illustration of a quadrophila ballon, either for Brandon, if he wants to take a look at it, or for any other curious person, of what a quadrophila wound ballon looks like. And also, related to atomic clocks, I have a bunch of atomic clocks. I've found that over the years, good quality atomic clocks have gotten more and more sensitive. When I first bought atomic clocks, I had to have them synchronized by putting them close to a window. Nowadays, I can put them any place, and my house has the old plastering with the chicken wire, so it's almost a Faraday cage. But it works. The new ones work excellent. I haven't noticed my one-year-old atomic clock giving me the wrong time yet, so much for that. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, I thought I would offer a link about an interesting little article from a recent New York Times edition. It's about a Carnegie Mellon math professor's rediscovering a method to solve quadratic equations that may go as far back as the days of the Babylonian Empire. Now, of course, I will spare this audience any attempt to do any justice over the radio. But if you're a bit of a math nerd, it'll be on my link page, roy.ac2gs.com, and you can check it out for yourself. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, for tonight's little puzzle, I took a little inspiration from last week's puzzle about the smallest dinosaur known to man, the hummingbird, and John, KC2SHO's observation about that Pixar movie WALL-E that had a spaceship with the same name, Axiom, which is the name of a company planning to construct tourist traps on the ISS. So I wondered how many TechNet listeners have watched the movie WALL-E. I tried to recall any kind of pertinent trivia from a movie that I thought the TechNet audience might know better, might have seen more. So personally, I came up with Citizen Kane. So for tonight's little puzzler, what very long-dead ancient creature was shown to be alive and well and moving around in the background of Citizen Kane? No movie fans at all? Citizen Kane, it's the classic, please. Try.
WB2GXM. Huh?
Yes, Rich.
I believe that would be the metal-ribbed rosebud.
So you're saying the wagon?
Oh, absolutely. Wasn't that what he was referring to all along?
Yeah, but a wagon isn't a long dead extinct creature.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Is it in the scene where they had all the junk? I mean, he was a collector. He had tons of stuff all over. Is it in that scene? And I don't think it was a wagon. It was a wooden sleigh for snow.
You're right, Paul. It was a sled. No, this was not. I'll give you that. It wasn't in the scene in of all the treasures that he had piled up. But you have to keep in mind, this would not be a stuffed animal. You know, what I'm trying to bring out is the weirdness that this is a apparently fully alive and functioning version of this creature who hasn't been seen on this earth for millions of years. Takers, it's prehistoric. It's about 60 million years ago. It's the age of dinosaurs. You know, what the hell? Guess.
I'll go with the Brontosaurus, WS2N. I have no idea. I don't. If it wasn't in that pile of junk, I mean, I remember looking at all the junk, but you'll have to tell us where you saw it, Roy.
Okay, I'll give you the time and the scene and ask if it jars anyone's memory. It's, I think, about an hour and 42 minutes into the movie. They go down a highway, and they're having a beachfront a party. And there's dancers and singers and stages set up on the beach. And in the background of one of the tents, you see the silhouette of these ancient creatures from millions of years ago walk past the background of the film.
It wouldn't happen to be an alligator, would it?
You're sort of close, although alligators aren't extinct, so that wouldn't qualify as the answer, but you're getting very warm.
The next time this comes on, turn a classic movie, I'll have to watch it.
And actually, for the benefit of anyone totally curious, I will link a YouTube video that just has that small snippet. so that you could catch the image, because it's fleeting. It's only about 10, 15 seconds. Basically, you see the silhouette of the number of pterodactyls flying in the background. You may ask, what the heck is pterodactyls doing in Citizen Kane? And apparently the story went that Orson Welles didn't have that much money to do that movie. The movie was not successful in its time, by the way. It had a lot of problems. William Randolph Hearst really hated it because it was basically about him, and it did not pose him to be a very nice person. So he tried as best he could to kill everything involved with it. But Orson Welles had very little money, so he used a lot of stock footage, and for some strange reason, he decided to use some stock footage from either 1933's King Kong or Son of Kong. There's some dispute over where the film came from. But sure enough, if you take a look at it, a couple of frames, as it pans across the tent, you see at least three pterodactyls flying about. So as my mini puzzler on top of the major puzzler, does anyone think a pterodactyl is a dinosaur?
A pterodactyl is a dinosaur, and being Orson Welles, you'd think he'd have done it on purpose.
I'm sure if you asked him, if he was still alive, he would probably wink at you and tell you, yes, he did, and there was some deep meaning in it, and he might even spend a couple of days trying to come up with that deep meaning with 20/20 hindsight. But unfortunately, no, that is a very common misconception. Pterodactyls were not actually dinosaurs. They were actually flying reptiles. So when the alligator was brought up, as I said, they were very close, because dinosaurs aren't really reptiles either. They're warm-blooded animals. And as we talked last week, some portions of them evolved into birds. You know, chickens and turkeys and all those fun things. So pterodactyls are actually reptiles and not dinosaurs, but they were very common during the age of the dinosaurs, and they are forever enshrined in Citizen Kane. So the next time Citizen Kane comes up, or if you want to see that scene, you just go to roy.ac2gs.com later today, and you can see that scene of the pterodactyls flying across the tent. Let me drop. If anyone has any topics or questions before I do my usual stories, I like to kind of leave that open for anyone. So if you have anything that you want to bring up, please feel free now.
Yeah, BDH with a comment about optical illusions that was in the news about 4 or 5 weeks ago.
Sure, I think I actually put up a link to an article that mentioned something like the top 10. Unfortunately, it doesn't lend itself well to radio, but I thought the link would have been interesting.
Yeah, this was an illusion that had won apparently some kind of award, and I saw it on my iPad on Apple News, but when I looked at it, It reminded me every bit of the old scope Lissajou patterns. As a matter of fact, it looked like a 3-to-2 frequency ratio of a Lissajou pattern, and I've always found those Lissajou patterns to be kind of optical illusionary, as it were. Go ahead.
I don't really recognize it from the description. What was the illusion? What did the illusion produce the illusion of?
Well, at sometimes it seems it was rotating around a horizontal axis. Other times it seems it was rotating around a vertical axis. And they would... to emphasize that they would show a bar either horizontally or vertically to bring it out, But when they took the bar away after a little bit of practice, you could sort of force either the horizontal or the vertical rotation just by force of will. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I've seen that. The problem is that there are some optically ambiguous images that we supply the physics for. You also see a somewhat similar version of that type of illusion in a instead of a statue, you know, where it's a solid projection, it's sort of a negative projection going inward instead of out. And at some angles of the light, it still looked like it's a statue. But as you rotate the, quote, statue, it begins to look very, very weird and strange. And then finally, at a tight angle, you can actually see from the shadows formed that it's actually an indentation and not a regular statue. So there's a lot of cases. What's going on for the most part is our optical systems have limited throughput, and it plays all kinds of very brilliant games to condense and concentrate and cut back on the throughput as much. So it cuts lots of corners. It makes a lot of assumptions that are based on normal macro world on Earth that we've evolved to, and most of the time it gets it right. And in the case of these optical illusions, it gets it wrong, but it doesn't harm anyone, and it's fun to play with. I love optical illusions.
GXM?
Yes, Rich.
At the risk of being a spoiler, that's basically how Disney created some of his most famous illusions in the Haunted Mansion, where these busts seem to watch you go by.
Indeed, it's an old trick, but a great trick, and one that keeps on fooling people. I've seen versions of that only about a month or two ago, so it's very popular, and still, people endlessly are amused by it. I've never known anyone who just kind of looks at it and said, "Yeah, I've seen that before," type of thing. I don't know. It's an enchanting aspect. Optical illusions. We sort of like to have ourselves tricked in a non-dangerous way. So when we find that something is tricking our senses, thankfully, we respond kind of amused by it. Anything else before I go on with my little stories? I have a new little segment that I thought I'd try out and see if people find amusing. But if anyone has any other topics or questions, please feel free. We've talked about television technology a great deal here on the TechNet. We've spoken about the new digital broadcast technologies. We've talked about high dynamic range TVs. We've talked about high frame rate TVs. We've talked about HD TVs, 4K TVs. We've even talked about the newest and greatest 8K TVs. We've talked about the two remaining commercial display technologies that define our the industry now, organic light-emitting diodes that are emissive displays, and the older, more mature liquid crystal displays, which are rather transmissive display screen technologies. Korea's LG display company is the primary manufacturer of all those organic light-emitting diode TV displays being sold. Some of these TVs are sold under LG Electronics' name, but many other manufacturers purchase OLED display screens from LG and then rebrand them along with their own electronics. Organic light-emitting diodes have many great abilities. Being an emissive display technology, it can have higher contrast ratios, it can have faster refresh rates, and it can have more vivid colors. Unfortunately, it has its own set of problems. It suffers to a degree from burn-in, and its blue OLED components degrade rather faster than the other two primary color organic light emitting diodes. Another problem is that they are more expensive than LCDs to manufacture, and there's no sign that any of these problems will be solved anytime too soon. In fact, it sort of looks like LG has stopped really trying for the 4K displays there. Research and development seems to be focused on trying to gear up to an 8K organic light-emitting diode display where the premium prices can still be very, very premium. Major television manufacturers like Samsung never got the organic light-emitting diode bandwagon, but you might have noticed that they are promoting some technology called QLED to compete against LG's organic light-emitting diodes. So I thought that exploring this new technology might be of interest tonight. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, the Q in QLED stands for quantum dots. Quantum dots are actually nanocrystals of semiconductor material. In Samsung's case, it's a crystal of cadmium telluride. They can grow these crystals in the lab in a very specific range of sizes. And when they're made in the 1 to 10 nanometer diameter range, they have some very interesting quantum mechanical properties. Now, each nanocrystal acts almost like a single atom. With a very specific valence electron energy level, as you shrink these nanocrystals to 1 nanometer diameter, its band gap energy, which is the energy difference between its valence band and its conduction band, goes up, and the light that it emits when its electrons are excited and then fall back to their valence band are short wavelength blue lights. If you let the nanocrystals grow to around 10 nanometers, the band gap energy for the nanocrystals decreases, so that the light that it emits is when an electron is excited and then allowed to drop back down to its valence band are longer wavelength red lights. So by manufacturing quantum dots that emit at television's three primary additive colors, red, green, and blue, you can use them instead of any subtractive color filter used in the much older LCD display technology. You see, older LCD displays usually use a bluish LED emitter behind the liquid crystal display, transmissive display. They add some yellow phosphorescent material to give the bluish LED a whitish appearance, and then the LCD's internal color filters remove the unneeded extra light from the display. With QLED, the yellow phosphorescent material is no longer needed, and the light-absorbing filters aren't needed as well. Instead, the blue light is used completely to energize the small quantum dots to emit the three primary colors that we need to perceive color. This not only allows QLED displays to be more efficient, but they boost the perceived color saturation of their displays. Quantum dot technology does not suffer from the fragility or burn-in problems or the high prices of OLEDs. One problem might be that the cadmium used to make these quantum dots is rather toxic or heavy metal. There may be problems when it comes time to junk that shiny new QLED TV someday. Quantum dot technology has certainly offered an improvement over the previous generation of LCD technology. But everyone is working on the next great thing to rule them all. Right now, the buzzword is micro-LED, inorganic LEDs that are very small, efficient, and stable. Now, all they have to do is figure out how to manufacture all those pixels without too many of them failing. The new 8K displays these days have as many as 33 million...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Hopefully I got to the end of it before it dropped me. So, once again, let me drop any questions or comments. This is AC2GX.
Okay, I come
to 33 million, and then you lost it.
Okay, 33 million was pretty much close to the end. I think I had two or three words after that. Yes, I don't remember if it was Rich or John.
GXM, Rich.
Rich, what do you got to say?
AC2GS, this is WB2GXM. So Roy, did you get any sense of how long the two new technologies would last in use, the QLED versus micro-LEDs? So I know LEDs, when they fail enough, become rather annoying.
It's not the stability, I think, that's the problem with using inorganic LEDs. It's simply the manufacturer and the required fail rate that would be acceptable. So if you are able to successfully manufacture an 8K display with almost all of your 33 million pixels lighting up, chances are it'll have as long a life, if not longer, than a quantum dot. Quantum dots are relatively stable structures, and so they don't really go bad too quickly. The problem with the technology is primarily the organic light-emitting diodes. The blue organic light-emitting diodes still are not quite up to it, and their stability is not good at all. They're going to be the first ones to go with any of this technology. So I think once they figure out how to do micro LEDs, that's probably going to be the next really, really big thing. It's just a matter of industrial design. How do you manufacture that many small components and ensure that most of them are viable?
Roy, there are animals, butterfly wings and I think certain kinds of hummingbirds, where the structure contains sub-microscopic holes, and the spacing of the holes gives you an iridescent effect or allows you to see certain colors. The color is not really there, but the spacing and wavelengths of the holes produces a color effect that the human eye will see. These quantum dots, being 1 nanometer in diameter, allows you to space them at certain spacings and clump them together certain ways. Optical frequencies of 400 to 700 nanometers. So 400 dots with the right spacing, a whole patch of them, even though the dots themselves are maybe blue emitters, but because of their spacing, could they simulate the wavelengths of the colors that we want to generate, even though you're not really generating that color? So can you do it with spacing like Mother Nature does with certain animal structures? AC2GS, K2RIW.
Dick, as you were talking, I was looking on my wall, and I happened to have a beautiful iridescent blue butterfly that is blue simply for that reason. Well, not simply, very complicatedly for that reason, that it had biologically designed nanostructures that produce interference patterns that look to us like a deep iridescent blue. But they do not use any dye. There is no absorption of chemicals and reflection back. It's purely an interference pattern. Could they do that? Probably yes. But they don't really think that they need to do that. It already works rather well for them. They primarily need material that will luminesce at red, green, and blue that's relatively stable. With these nanocrystals, their resonant frequencies that they luminesce at is very easily determined by how long you cook them in their little beaker. So if you grow them to 1 nanometer, especially something like cadmium telluride, you basically get a blue luminescent material. If you grow it to about 5 nanometers, you get a green, and when you grow it to 10 nanometers, you get a nice red. Once you put a lipid layer around it, a kind of a soap layer where it's hydrophobic over the crystal and hydrophilic at the other ends, like soap bubbles work, you can then put it in a liquid solution and fill each area that used to have color filters. So you don't have to worry. It would be an incredibly big undertaking of the nanotechnology to build the interference pattern the way that the butterflies do.
Very nice. These displays, with all this capability, slowly coming down to a nice price, and I think you've already said they've got reasonable longevity.
unfortunately, the market in flat panel TV sets have kind of shrunken. They've been commoditized. The organic light emitting diodes still cost a great deal. They're only manufactured by LG. They're not doing well with upgrading the technology. They tried to make it bigger. They tried to make it less expensive. They haven't been able to make it less expensive. So if anything, the new models of televisions that are going to come out this year are probably not going to have much in the way of additional functionality and will probably end up costing a couple of bucks. But the quantum dot-enabled liquid crystal displays are at this point the best bang for the buck, if you will. They last you a long time. There's still some marginal benefits to organic light-emitting diode displays. The dynamic range, the contrast is better, but everything else is reasonably good with the quantum LCDs, and most people are buying those because the price differential is somewhat embarrassing. I mean, if you got a lot of money to just waste, then organic light-emitting diodes for a couple of years until the blue fades on you is very attractive. But quantum LCDs have made Samsung, I think, the number one television seller this past year, and probably it'll go on next year.
In the past, and I own one of these things, there is a kind of display, I think it's LCD, but I'm not sure, which has a compact fluorescent tube giving the background lighting, and then the electronic flat screen in front of that creates the red, green, and blue by changing the amount of opacity. That compact fluorescent tube, when it ages, I think doesn't put out pure white light anymore. It starts drifting, and it also develops hot spots. So a compact fluorescent tube type illuminated, back illuminated display, I think has a finite life, some number of years beyond which it's not quite as pleasant to look through. And I think I'm starting to see that because I see some spots across the screen where the screen is not as bright as it used to be. It's got some dimmer areas. Over to you for any comments on all of the above, Roy. I used to ask these questions to Eric, who used to be our television expert. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
Yes, indeed. I remember those discussions. And in memory of Eric, I will just say the term discrete sign transforms, because he mentioned it just about every time he was talking about television transmissions. It's a method of compressing data for digital television. But that technology that you speak of is kind of been retired for the most part. I remember replacing my cold fluorescent cathode light emitter from a laptop because it used the exact same technology. At the very top was a fluorescent tube, and it would emit light down and be redirected towards the display, and then the LCD and the color filters would do the rest of the job. For the most part, as far as I'm aware, they've been completely replaced by light-emitting diodes in the back. The old technology is that they use the bluish UV type of light-emitting diode and coated it with a little phosphorescent white-yellow material. And over the last few years, what they've done is they've made multiple small areas of the light-emitting diode so that in a total TV screen there might be, they started with four regions, then they upped it to 16, and then 32, and they keep doubling up. So with localized light control of the background, they're able to boost the contrast as long as it's amenable to the region. So nowadays, if you look at the back of most LCD displays, there are multiple LED emitters on the background, and the fluorescents have gone bye-bye. But yeah, they age, and they shift in color, they shift in quality, they shift in emission across the tube, so they were very problematic.
I'm not sure if my set is 5 years old, but something like that. So I think you're saying five-year-old sets are reasonably problematic, and it's time I update. Over to you, Roy.
It depends on what you like and what's important, and if you get enjoyment out of the machine. There are some people, I know people who haven't even bothered to switch their channel selectors from the standard definition broadcast to the high definition broadcast. It's just not important to them. I have a HD television from, I guess it was about 5 years ago. That was when they made that big 3D push that everyone had to have 3D in their TV. You know, now these things are somewhat out of date. I have two flat plane television. One is an old style LCD. The other is a old style plasma cell, which had very nice specs. It had its own problems like anything else. But, you know, every few years the technology gets better and you have to sort of decide whether it's just marketing nonsense or it's going to make you feel better. I don't understand, and I had these arguments in the past with Eric about 8K. You know, unless you're getting yourself a 500-inch screen, I don't see where 8K is useful. I can barely make out the difference between, 720 and 1440. But, you know, we're soon going to be assaulted by 8K display. We have to decide whether we want to spend that ridiculous amount of money. But thankfully, as I mentioned before, LCD displays have plummeted in price. You can get beautiful, large television sets for a fraction of what it would have cost you a few years ago.
I can respond about 8K.
Hey, Wesley, feel free.
When you have a 1080p that is downscaled of 4K, so you take 4K video and downscale it to 1080p. Now you compare the 1080p with another 1080p that was filmed by the same camera that is 1080p. You see the huge resolution difference. Second job. Now there is another example. You take a 5.7K, which I have with my EVA1 Panasonic, and you downscale it to 4K. So you take all of those available pixels, you just sort of shrink it to fit to 4K. And now your 4K looks much better than the same 4K that was filmed by the camera 4K. And then if you take 8K, it's a nonsense. It's a complete nonsense. But when you now shrink 8K to 4K, now that 4K is much better than 5.7K filmed by my EVA1 Panasonic that is also scaled down to 4K. So that's what the industry is moving at. And to exchange.
Okay, Wesley, that makes good sense as far as the producers of software, the film. It doesn't really make sense for Joe Public to buy a TV set because if it's downscaled and it looks pretty good, then it still looks pretty good. What might be a selling point at some point among marketers, and it might be a little bit more realistic than the 8K, is the newer, higher dynamic range screen capability that you're able to get a larger gamut of the colors. Now, some people don't care. They don't care if their blues are bluer. They don't care if the color scheme is a little bit more accurate than the old smaller color gamut was capable of. But that might be a selling point. But that's a good selling point that you mentioned, Wesley, for the recorders, for the cameras. Most of us don't buy the cameras. Most of us buy the TV set.
Well, you need to remember one thing. Anything that you see on the TV was filmed or prepared by anything that is capable of filming or making the visual representation of whatever is the, put into the pixels. So when we talk about a pixel size, after the 4K, you physically are not able to see the difference between 5.7K, 6K, which is Blackmagic Pocket Cinema Camera 6K right now. It's $2,499. Or you go for Z1 or any other cameras like Arri that goes to 8K. So what, when you talk about a screen, something has to be on that screen. So it makes a sense just because screen by itself without the motion picture or any kind of picture doesn't make any sense. Did you get what I'm trying to say? And
yeah, Wesley, I understand that you need the actual movies. You need the videos. I'm just saying that from Joe Public, who buys a color TV set, and they look at the 4K, and the salesman is trying to upsell you to the 8K. And for those guys, they have nothing to do with producing the images. They're simply looking at the images. Most of them, you need to wear glasses to see anything. I'm just saying that I think it's overkill and more marketing. I think the high dynamic range might be a benefit, but when you start to get to 8K and such, I mean, as far as manufacturers, producers of the images, it allows for all kinds of fun stuff for them to do, and I understand and appreciate that. I'm just saying that when it gets to the television set itself, it's a little bit overkill in my humble opinion.
When you're looking at the dynamic of the picture, the new direction for the TV is HDR. Sort of lying to the viewer. In other words, is when you try to play with HDR, the Direct 709 was the standard before, and then there was 2020, and now we have HDR, and a viewer or the guy who bought that, well, whatever the TV, 1080p. 2K, 4K, whatever you take, let me drop. That guy is looking at the picture based on his own experience of playing with HDR. So he practically, what is HDR? You have something that is called LUT, L-U-T, which is a color mask, and that color mask could be morning, sun, or it could be a daytime or cloudy. Or it's not that the picture would be cloudy, it's just that color that was taken by you who have that HDR TV is that what you wanted. And then the next 10 minutes, you're watching something that's supposed to be very much enthusiastic, and you have that cloudy lot that you actually put on that HDR, and the picture sucks. So you either constantly change the lot on it, or you simply give it up. So, yes, we're going to the kind of nonsense with it, but that's where the TV is going.
Hey, Wesley, and by the way, for the audience, LUT really stands for lookup tables. It simply takes color codes and translates them to different color codes, and people are able to adjust what the color balance is for the image. That's what a LUT and L-U-T is, a lookup table.
Yeah, so from customer perspective, you're right. 4K is the top. So whatever they do is because it's good for the sales. So yes, they can go for 6K. You're not gonna see the difference. They can go for 8K. You're not gonna see the difference. Well, you're gonna see the difference in your money spent. But the picture your eye is not able to recognize over anything over 4K. N2X3, thank you.
Hey, Wes, you and I are in perfect agreement on that. Let me move on to my next little story. I don't want to depress anyone with Wuhan stories, but it seems to be a regular. And I'm working against the clock right now.
Bird attach.
Okay, so I don't know if any of you are following the unfolding story that is the Wuhan coronavirus, but early on there was a Chinese doctor who shared some guarded warnings on a Chinese social app, and he was invited for tea at the police station. As though they quaintly describe the Chinese lack of freedom of speech, he was requested to sign a statement that he would cease to spread any more unsubstantiated rumors, and because he was a doctor and needed to help to treat the unsubstantiated rumor, that was the Wuhan coronavirus, he was sent back to his hospital to treat many of the people dying from the unsubstantiated viral rumor. While treating the victims of the unsubstantiated viral rumor, he unfortunately contracted the same virus and died last week. Now, China's ruling Communist Party, bending to public pressure, said this past Friday that it would send a team from its powerful anti-corruption committee to investigate the issues surrounding a whistleblower doctor who had died hours earlier in Wuhan, the epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak. The doctor, Li Wanliang, who was among the first to warn about the outbreak, only to be silenced by the police, died on Friday after becoming himself infected with the virus, the hospital treating him reported. The death of the 34-year-old doctor announced early Friday by Wuhan City Central Hospital set off an outpouring of grief and anger on social media with commenters on Weibo, a Twitter-like website demanding an apology from the authorities to Dr. Li and his family. The State Supervisory Committee has decided to send an investigation team to Wuhan, Hubei Province, to conduct a comprehensive investigation on related issues reported by the masses about Dr. Li Wenliang, it said on Friday in a one-line statement on its website. It is rare for the Communist Party to react so swiftly to public outrage. Several top officials of state-run media outlets had also joined in the chorus to mourn Dr. Li's death. In statements online, the National Health Commission and the Wuhan government said that they expressed their condolences. The police and others questioned Dr. Li in early January after he warned a circle of medical school classmates on December 30th about a viral outbreak, and he said it appeared to be very similar to SARS. The police compelled him to sign a statement denouncing his warning as unfounded and illegal rumor. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2.
Concerning the coronavirus, Roy, I vaguely remember that there's something like 39,000 people in the world who now have it, and something like 800 people have died. Correct me on those numbers, and compare that to the flu that we have. It seems like we lose 20,000 people dying of that flu. I'm not quite sure how many people get it, but is the lethality ratio of the coronavirus higher or lower than the flu? And if the number of people who get and die flu is larger, it's amazing that we're not alarmed by flu, but yet we're very alarmed by coronavirus. So how many people have coronavirus? Over to you, Paul Avery, AC2GS, K2RW.
Well, you know, it changes every hour, unfortunately. Now, depending upon how much you believe the Chinese government, there are over 4,000 cases of coronaviruses. There are 910 documented deaths from coronavirus. It is, that passes SARS. SARS, I think, the only reported numbers were around 800. So when it passed 800, theoretically, it killed more people than SARS back in 2002-2003. It is more infectious. The coronavirus appears to be more infectious than the SARS virus. but less infectious than influenza. The problem is with epidemiology, it's kind of a complicated mishmash of how infectious it is and how mortal, how the mortality rate is. So we don't really have very hard and firm numbers. Matter of fact, my next little story will kind of give you a little bit more information about the coronavirus these days. On to part B, and if you have any further questions about coronaviruses, feel free. Everyone's been so busy treating and burying victims of this virus that they feel that they need to put in additional effort to come up with a catchy name for the darn thing. The World Health Organization has been calling it the 2019 nCoV, which stands for Novel Coronavirus of 2019. But most people have taken to calling it just plain coronavirus. It's a term felt to be a little too general by the epidemiologists tracking this particular version of it. The International Committee on Taxonomy of Viruses seems to have naming rights. The organization has submitted a name to a scientific journal and hopes to reveal it within the next few days, according to the BBC. Meanwhile, the Chinese government has come up with its own unique name for the virus, which in English will be called NCP, for Novel Coronavirus Pneumonia, and has ordered all of their local authorities and state news media to adopt this term. Meanwhile, on to more significant new facts about the global menace. As I mentioned before, the latest reports brought the total number of deaths in China to at least 910, and the total number of confirmed cases rose to 40,553. Patients suffering from the coronavirus have been documented in China, Hong Kong, Macau, Taiwan, Australia, Belgium, Cambodia, Canada, Finland, France, Germany, India, Italy, Japan, Malaysia, Nepal, Philippines, Russia, Sri Lanka, Singapore, Spain, Sweden, Thailand, South Korea, the United Arab Emirates, the United Kingdom, and the United States and Vietnam. Many doctors believe that the deaths and infections in China are undercounted because hospitals and laboratories are under severe strain to test for the virus. Let me drop for a sec. Not even considering the bureaucratic strain on the Chinese government these days, China has not been terribly transparent about its infectious disease rate in the past. As an example, the United States has a population of about 330 million people, and we lost 80,000 people in 2017-2018 due to that year's influenza. China, a country with a population of about 1.4 billion people, reported only 95 deaths due to influenza in 2017 and 2018. Now, China has let their influenza mortality rates creep up a little bit since it was first noticed and publicized, but many foreign epidemiologists don't trust the Chinese government's release numbers for the Wuhan coronavirus. I'll post a site that actually plots the total coronavirus cases and the deaths, which appear to be growing linearly, which is better than it's rising logarithmically. Some people are signing up on face masks. Keep in mind that regular generic face masks don't really do much. If you're interested in actually somewhat useful face masks, there's a type called N95, which is designed with pores that will stop approximately 95% of viral particles from getting through the filtration system. So if you can find N95 and you're concerned, you might want to consider that. But the regular masks really don't do much. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
The face mask that people wear is the theory of operation that the aerosol particles that might contain the virus stick to the outside of the mask, don't penetrate the mask even though you're breathing through it, and therefore it somewhat limits your exposure. Is that the theory of operation? And I guess the real protection would be from a full-blown gas mask, which of course would be very bulky to walk around with and very expensive, and you have to replace the filters probably every day. So I presume face masks give you a 2-to-1 advantage, but it's not a huge improvement in cutting down the infection rate is a bunch of guesses on my part. Over to you, Roy.
Although there are all kinds of masks, and there are very scary masks that are probably even safer to use, that are more expensive and more uncomfortable and more inconvenient and require expensive cartridges to be changed, again, a reasonable compromise is the N95 classification. If you Google them, you can find them all over the place, although they're being bought up all over the place, so they're probably not available. But N95s usually look sort of like the regular cloth, except that there's only a small punched hole in the middle with a proper filter, and that will filter 95% of the viral particles out. These cloth things are probably more in the other direction. If you cough with them on, you might spare the environment a few of your aerosolized viral droplets, but not much. Most epidemiologists I've been reading really don't think that the generic cloth masks do much of anything except give people a kind of false sense of security. You know, N95s are probably the way to go.
Is that November 95 or Mike 95?
It is November 95.
November 95, roughly how expensive are they, Roy?
Yeah, well, they come in all kinds of shapes and sizes. They aren't that ridiculously expensive. They probably cost about 10 times the price of regular cloth. You know, you can pick up maybe 20 for about 20 bucks or something. And the problem is it's not something you could just rinse out and clean. Once you've kind of stuffed up the pores and you have problems breathing through the filter system, that's when it's time to throw that one away and get another one. But they're not ridiculously expensive. You know, the ones I think you were thinking of, they're basically gas masks, are orders of magnitude more expensive.
American Hapkin. WB2AHK.
W2BHK.
Right, W Baker 2 Alpha Hotel Kilo. I just looked it up real quick on a Google search, and Walmart sells it, and they have a price. Walmart has a price of one mask, $23.32. How long could that mask last before you have to change it? It'd be awfully expensive if you have to get a new one every day. Over.
That's no kind of a deal. I've looked around. I think the problem, unfortunately, is that websites don't update their inventory. So I know at least on the West Coast, they kind of bought up all the N95s, even though they're listed on the websites. If you try and order them, you have problems. But most of the ones I've seen before the panic set in were significantly less expensive than that. That's the problem. These things are designed to be disposable. As far as I'm concerned, $20 is not a disposable item. So I'm not quite sure what version of an N95 filter that is. But often, the ones that I've seen basically look like a plastic face mask with a punched-out hole where the filtration system is inserted.
Yeah, that's what it looks like. There's like a square projection in the middle of it. All right, thanks a lot, Doug. Good information there, Doctor. WB2AHK clear.
Okay, very well. Anyone with any other questions or comments before I roll it up for tonight?
I like to say Buttigieg.
Just want to address, Dick had a concern, and I understand and agree in many ways. This might be more of a scare than is warranted in some ways. The problem with, again, human nature, you know, we were talking earlier about optical illusions and cognitive problems that people have is for some odd reason, the idea that 80,000 people died of influenza in the United States last year doesn't really strike our conscious.